You're listening to Just One of the Guys, where you don't have to go home, but you can't stay here.
Closing time, open all the doors and let you out into the world.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of Just One of the Guys, a Green Lantern podcast hosted by the Two Jew Freaks Internet Radio Network. Hi there, my name's Sean Ingle, and when I'm not trying to be the next Lord of the Dance, I love Michael Flatley, I'm doing the coverage of Green Lantern comics starting with the cover date June 1990 and ending with the cover date November 2004, while putting a special emphasis on the characters of Guy Gardner and Kyle Rayner. And this time out, luckily we're going to be covering books that cover both those characters, so yay! Except, you know, one of those books that we're going to be covering is Green Lantern 80-page giant number 1, which is a giant inventory dummy. Oh yes, it's got stories about Guy Gardner. In fact, it's got a Bo Smith and Mitch Bird pen story about Guy Gardner. That doesn't mean it's all that good. Plus, we also have issue 125 of Green Lantern as well, which, sadly, is the last issue that Ron Mars is on until basically in the end of this series. I think my guest and I will probably have a lot of things to talk about this final issue of Ron Mars' run. And let me introduce this guest to you. He's a person that you should all know. He's been a frequent guest over here. And he is also the co-host of one of the best podcasts out on the internet, Better in the Dark, with his best friend Derek Ferguson. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure to welcome back to the show the inevitable Thomas DJ. Hey, Tom, how's it going?
Hey, just give me a second. I got to adjust this uniform because it's really tight in the crotch.
Oh, God, no. Yeah, we'll probably get into talking about Green Lantern Batch here on the show, which is always something that I just so thoroughly enjoy talking about. But yeah, this time out, it's Green Lantern number 25, another, I hate to say, inventory-tastic story, as well as Green Lantern Giant, or Green Lantern 80-page Giant number 1. So, do you have any specific comments on these before we get to the break?
Well, it's 80-page Giant should just go away. But I think there's sadness both for the right reasons and the wrong reasons with this issue of Green Lantern.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but on the other hand, on the bad side, 4 issues of Ben Rabe. Go away, Ben Rabe.
Yeah, I've looked kind of ahead, and it's a little stretch before we get to the Judd Winnick era, and gotta suffer through some. And then other people writing.
When Judd Winnick leaves, we get more Ben Rabe. Go away, Ben Rabe. I mean, he ruined Excalibur for me.
Oh dear Lord!
Because I was reading Excalibur during the Warren Ellis run, and Warren Ellis introduced one of my favorite X characters, Pete Wisdom, and then Ben Rabe comes along and ruins Pete Wisdom and ruins everything that's good about Excalibur. So go away, Ben Rabe.
You're not making me look forward to what's going to be coming up, Thomas. That's what I'm going to say.
But we get... Thank you. But we get Judd Winnick. The only thing I've ever liked that I've read of Judd Winnick is coming.
Well, then, at least I've got something to look forward with that. So, there's a bright light in the darkness that is Ben Rabe. So,
go away, Ben Rabe.
But we'll be taking a look at it. Well, not Ben Rabe, thankfully, but the last issue of Green... not the last issue of Green Lantern. The last issue of Ron Mars on Green Lantern, right after we play these podcast promo breaks. Thanks. God, I need to swear.
Closing time. Every new beginning comes from some other beginning's end.
Mr. Scott, shall we give the Enterprise a proper shakedown?
I would say it's time for that, sir. Aye.
Aye. before this drama unfolds, we give welcome to the ones named Kirk and Spock.
You! What planet is this?
Which one of you is the captain?
Did we violate the treaty, Captain?
Sir, someone is stealing the Enterprise.
What are you scratching at?
Humans make illogical decisions.
Destruct sequence completed and engaged.
No! Yes, I follow Mr. Spock! I'm talking to Mr. Spock, you understand?
Starfleet, do you read? This is the Enterprise. We are under attack.
Fire, Mr. Scott.
Star Trek, Monthly Monday, covering every episode of the classic original TV series in randomly selected order, on the second Monday of every month, at twotruefreaks.com.
Well then, Scott, can you do me a favor?
What's that?
I've got an episode coming. Let's see. It's called Magnus Remembers Superman Returns, so don't listen to that episode. It's all part of my Superman Begins like miniseries that I'm going through or was going through. This is all part of the lead up to Man of Steel coming out on Blu-ray, right?
Mm-hmm.
I've got two little interludes. The first. Lucy, shut the f*** up! Sorry about that, it's the dog.
Friend is Magnus punches reality at twotruefreaks.com. Discussion about comics, movies, and TV shows. Trentus Magnus punches reality every Tuesday at twotruefreaks.com.
No animals were harmed in the making of this promo.
Okay, and we are back. So, we're going to skip emails this time. If you want to write into the show, the email address, of course, is justonetheguyspodcast@gmail.com. Write in emails, and I'll read them on the next show. But for right now, we're going to get into coverage of Green Lantern number 125. This one was cover dated June 2000 and released on April 5th, 2000, with a cover price of $1.99 US and $3.25 Canada, and the title of the book was Tomb Raider. Sadly, no Angelina Jolie here. Writer was Ron Mars, penciler was Jeff Johnson, inker Keith Aiken, not Clay Aiken, thankfully. Colors and separations were Rob Schwager.
There's no creepy songs about being invisible in this issue.
And sadly, no Kelly Clarkson to slap him around and try and make
Kelly
him.
Kelly Clarkson.
Ooh, Kelly Clarkson and Angelina Jolie in a sandwich. That'd be nice. Colors and separations were by Rob Schwager. The letterer was Sean Conant, not Koloth, that's a Klingon name. Assistant editor was L.A. Williams, and the editor was Bob Schreck. Our story opens with Green Lantern Kyle Rayner fending off the elastic affectations of fellow Justice League member Plastic Man. Having shown up late to the latest JLA meeting due to his run-in with the controllers, Kyle has Plaz fill him in on what went down. Eel O'Brien tells Kyle that the League is planning on expanding the Watchtower moon base, and since he was late to the planning meeting, he got pegged to make the necessary expansions. In fact, Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman all think he'd do a bang-up job on his own. Even the Martian Manhunter is reluctant to help Kyle out. So, with all the Leaguers opting out of tunneling duty, well, all the Leaguers that Kyle would want to work with, Kyle heads into the catacombs under the Watchtower. After bringing up a JLA version of the Seven Dwarves to dig, 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 dig the whole day through, Kyle discovers a panel with some strange writing on it. On further investigation, he discovers that it's an ancient door, which of course he opens and discovers a chamber filled with insectoid-like robots. Also, of course, as Kyle approaches the dormant droids, they spring to life and open fire on him. On instinct, Kyle rings up a series of consequences, copyright Alan and Emily Middleton, 2014, all rights reserved, and takes down the mechanized menace. After destroying most of the robots, Kyle heads to the cocoon-like chamber in the center of the room to see what they're protecting. Giving the pillar a touch, Kyle sees the column open up, and an alien analog to the robots spring to life from within. Kyle tries to communicate with the giant golden grasshopper, but only gets energy blast aimed at him as a response. Realizing that the robots were there to keep the alien in the cocoon, Kyle powers up one of the not-too-badly-damaged robots and has it wrap the rampaging alien in some yellow energy bands, subduing it once more. Crisis averted, Kyle puts the bound bug back in his chamber and heads back to the watchtower for some Oreos with John. The end. Kind of a sad ending for Ron Mars's run, because this really feels like a rushed inventory issue. I mean, it's not bad, but it just feels so inconsequential on the run of it.
You get the impression this was not meant to be his last issue.
No, it definitely, like I said earlier, it feels very much like an inventory story, something that was written to maybe be a fill-in for a JLA issue, because it doesn't feel like it's, aside from Kyle mentioning the fact that he was out in space dealing with the controllers the past couple issues, it really has nothing to do with the overall story arc in Green Lantern, and it just feels like it's kind of shoved in here. And you would think, now granted, 25 issues or 125 issues of comic isn't the thing like a 100 or 200 or anything like that, but it is sort of an anniversary issue, and you would think there'd be a bit more pomp and circumstance put behind it. But no, this is just really sad, and to know that this is going to be, until the end of the book, the last issue with Ron Mars on it is kind of disappointing. I don't know.
Yeah, it's a comic.
It feels like Ron Mars has done so much to establish Kyle Rayner as a character. He's taken him from what we had in the pre, Emerald Dawn, version,
right,
and developed the character so much and made him such an interesting character and done so much work with not only him, but the ancillary characters of John and Guy, plus, respectfully treating Hal Jordan well in not only the Emerald Knight storyline around the hundreds, right, the Final Knight storyline. He's done a really amazing job with the character of Green Lantern, and for him to go out on such a kind of down note is just really disappointing. But if you want, we'll go ahead and go into the issue specific. I'm taking a look at the cover, and the cover is done by Brian Stelfreeze, who's usually a pretty good artist. But again, this feels rushed as well.
Right. It's like Stelfreeze didn't have his heart in it.
Yeah. It's not bad, but it's just a very bland background. The pose is kind of dynamic, but it just feels like it's all phoned in, which is really disappointing for what should be an anniversary and should be the final issue. It's a going out with a whimper rather than a bang.
It could be worse, though. It could have just been a shot of, Kyle looking very grim standing in front of a wall.
Yeah, at least there is a bit of dynamism, with Kyle fighting some of the robots. So I guess that's good. But yeah, otherwise it's kind of a down issue. Let's see. I really don't have all that many notes in here. Page 2. What do I have? Page 2, panel 4. I didn't notice this until I was doing my notes. But I like that Plastic Man, who's just a goofy character at this point in time, is making a symbol of a question mark when he's asking the question with Kyle. So it's a nice visual cue here as well, with Plastic Man being sort of the stretchy, make weird shapes guy.
That's pretty much
It's sad that I don't have, you know, I'm trying to run through here and find,
you know, Jeff Johnson does a nice Trinity.
Oh yeah. On page four, they look a heck of a lot better. Last time Jeff Johnson, did the Justice League was around issue 100. I think it was like issue 102 or 103, where Hal was doing the whole Emerald Knights thing and Hal was being accepted by the Justice League. And in that issue, Wonder Woman and Superman and the various members of the League just really looked off. Here they look a lot better, I think. And I will comment on this on page four, the final panel, where Batman tells Kyle to buy a watch.
Yeah.
I'm like, is Batman trying to be humorous? Because that's not Batman from this era. And I was like, Batman's kind of cracking a joke here. And I thought that was kind of... I like that, but yeah, I'm just trying to find things in this comic that I really enjoy, and I'm not down on it, but it's just average sad.
I find it also very funny that in the second panel, Superman gets briefly played by a very young Richard Nixon.
My God, that is a very Nixon-esque pose there. I think it's just the oversized nose.
That
look, because, you know, he looks good in that first panel, the sort of larger, almost half page splash there of the Trinity standing. But yeah, that's kind of awkward. And even John disses Kyle. So yeah, nobody loves Kyle at the time.
that was a CBS sitcom.
Nobody loves Kyle.
It was on next. It's like Everybody Loves Raymond, followed by Everybody. Nobody loves Kyle.
Maybe we can expect that, you know, as a sort of offshoot when the CW does their Green Lantern show. Nobody loves Kyle.
They'll just like recut it for a half an hour as a sitcom. Just like Ally McBeal became Ally.
Oh Lord, don't bring up Ally McBeal. My next note is on the page where Kyle's ringed up the seven dwarves.
Yes.
You know, I think that I it's decent art, and I like, you know, I know the Magnificent Seven is an idea that Michael Bailey's talked about a lot with the characters of the Justice League and how important they are to the overall DC universe. Except, you know, one of the members, of course, isn't Green Lantern. It's Plastic Man that he's ringed up, because, you know, I guess that'd be too on the nose if he ringed up himself. Yeah.
Well, I think it's just that these are the people he's mad at, right?
Yeah, now. Makes sense. But it's decent art, but I really...
I kind of like the fact that Batman has a stupid face on.
He does have kind of that ooh kind of look. And Superman's not that much bad. Superman's not much bad. They're all very... Again, it's dealing with the anime style that Kyle's into, so it's got that kind of look in their facial features. Aquaman's got the big anime eyes as well.
Yeah.
And Superman, well, I'm looking at this one thing. Well, no, the one panel is Superman's S looks a little off, but, you know, whatever. I did make a note on the next page, on page 7. I always enjoy when Ron Mars puts in... actual historical characters in his book. I know he's talked about various different sort of obscure artists when Kyle's talking about his artwork, because I know he talked about a character named Lydecker, who was a sort of contemporary of Norman Rockwell at the time. And in here he makes a comment about how often does he get to play Howard Carter.
Yes.
And Howard Carter is a renowned Egyptologist. He did a lot of excavations during the early 20th century in Egypt. So I like the fact that Kyle is a knowledgeable character and has some idea of who a person who would be doing the same sort of thing is. So, but
Although I find that every time a major comic book company does something on the moon, there's always aliens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's a cheap sort of, but you know, that's always the idea. There's always going to be aliens on Mars, and there's always going to be aliens on the moon. It brings into light, I guess, the idea that we're not the first ones here, that there are people before us. And then this giant sarcophagus, or this giant antechamber filled with all these weird bug-like aliens. You know, it's just kind of a bland design as well. It's not wholly original, but it's not anything that I think is, I don't know, it's just average, which is the thing that disappoints me about this book. I don't like my Green Lantern comics, especially from this era, being average, and this is just what this is.
It's Ron Mars and Jeff Johnson's version of the scene with the animated statue in Tomb Raider.
Mm-hmm. Now I'm wondering, had Tomb Raider this had to have come out before the Angelina Jolie movie, because this came out in April of 2000. I'm gonna do a quick IMDb check. Now, this says that Tomb Raider, Lara Croft Tomb Raider, came out in 2001. Now, it may have been promoted, because I know the game was obviously very popular at this mm-hmm. time. But and Simon West did it, you know, and he's not a bad director, too. And we were talking earlier off air about, you know, good directors doing bad movies. So, mm-hmm. I really don't have any specific notes until page 12, panel one, where Kyle repeats the line from The Day the Earth Stood Still. The first one, the one that wasn't with
the good one, guys.
The wasn't the one with Johnny Bueno or Johnny Bravo or whatever the hell his name is.
Johnny Utah,
yeah, whatever. But you know, Kyle, yeah, again, that's a little clever thing that Kyle would think of that line, the Klaatu Barada Nikto thing, right, to try and stop the aliens. But other than that, it's all just a big
I like fight. The fact that he's playing Jesse Ventura from Predator at one point.
Oh yeah, that's, you know, the thing is, the artwork's not bad. Johnson mm-hmm. does a good job. I've seen Johnson do significantly worse. It's very dynamic, but it's just very meh. There's not a lot going on. It doesn't seem to really play into the overall. It just seems like, you know, like I said, it's an inventory story. I really don't have, after that, all that many notes. I mean, Kyle finds the big bug alien, can't communicate with it, and realizes that the little robots were there to keep this bug alien in its little sarcophagus thing.
Which is not exactly an original idea to begin with.
No. And that's the thing. It seems very rushed. It seems very slapped together. It doesn't seem like... It just seems so throwaway, which is sad for the ending of what I consider to be a really great run by Mars. I mean, granted, there are bits and pieces in there that aren't stellar, but overall, the Ron Mars run, at least for me, has been just probably one of the best runs on Green Lantern that I've read. Mm-hmm. Now, I know everyone nowadays worships at the altar of Jeff Johns and thinks Jeff Johns' run on Green Lantern is the definitive one, but I'd be hard pressed to see how it could be much better than Ron Mars' run. And the fact and the fact that it ends on this sort of down note, just maybe that's the reason that people feel that Geoff Johns was such an innovator and such the Green Lantern guy, when I think Ron Mars should have that title. But maybe that's just me.
I think the main difference is, though, that Geoff Johns, F you, Geoff Johns, was doing Hal Jordan, whereas Ron Mars was establishing a new character,
mm-hmm.
and was also struggling against the fans and the other writers, except for Grant Morrison, who was like, "Look, I really like your character."
Oh yeah, and I think that's a much harder job for Ron Mars to do, which cements the idea that he is a better writer or a better writer of Green Lantern than Geoff Johns is, because all Geoff Johns is had to take an established character and do some new things with it. Mars had to take a completely new character, build him up from nothing, and turn him into this incredible Green Lantern. And I'm kind of at a loss for words. You know, it's like I said, it's just sad that a run that I thought was exemplary, Mars's run on this character, building him up from nothing and turning him into this character, was really so amazing, and to see him just go out like this is just, it's depressing. But hopefully we'll get better stories down the line with Ben Rabe and Jay Faerber.
Got Judd Winnick.
We've got
his run is very good.
Okay, well, like I've said before in the episodes, this is about where I cut off, because I started my family. We were about ready to have our first kid. No, we had already had our first kid by this time, so I kind of put comic collecting away for a while, and all this stuff from now on is pretty much new. So I'm sad to see Ron Mars go, but I'm interested to see where Judd Winnick will take us. Unfortunately, we have to set through some.
It's kind of funny that the last image of Ron Mars, first run, because he does come back to ring down the curtain on the character, is Kyle kind of walking away and closing the door.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did say that that final page of the book was, in a way, Ron Mars just basically saying goodbye, but it's such an understated way of doing it that it just leads me to believe that Ron Mars maybe was kind of upset with his run, I'd love to find out more about that. I may have to make an effort to see if I can get in touch with Ron Mars and maybe set up an interview with him. And if you'd be willing to, Thomas, I'd love to have you come on like we did,
of course,
with Smith, and talk to Ron Mars, because I have nothing but praise for Ron Mars's run, except for some of his ancillary villains.
Great. I wonder if Ron Mars was a Doctor Who fan. Because this last page has little echoes of the last scene in the last classic Who story, which was called Survival.
Oh, yeah?
Which has Sylvester McCoy and Ace walking away from the camera, and there's like a very badly overdubbed narration that was done at the very last minute. Because they didn't know they were not being renewed. Because Doctor Who was never canceled.
Oh, yeah.
It was just not renewed.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a similar speech that Sylvester McCoy gives about somewhere there's injustice, somewhere there's violence, somewhere there's tea being brewed. And there's a very similar feel to this last page.
Yeah, I could see something like that. And it'd be interesting, it'd be interesting to know if Mars was a fan of Doctor Who, because that also falls into, one of the other shows that we love doing. So it'd be interesting to talk with him. I will see.
And well, since we're talking about Who True Feeks, future Shag.
Oh, we had to get that in. But yeah, kind of the end of a era, Ron Mars's run, and sadly kind of a not really a letdown, but just kind of a leaving with a whimper rather than a bang. So yeah, there you go.
Sad hosts.
Well, hopefully the second issue and that we're going to be covering today, the Green Lantern 80-page giant number one, will make us happy.
No.
We'll be covering that after this podcast promo commercial break.
Tangent, an abrupt change of course.
Tangent, to go off suddenly in another direction or on a different line of thought.
Tangent, a comic event featuring brand new characters with very familiar names.
I'm waking up to ash and dust. I wipe my brow and I sweat my rust. I'm breathing in the chemicals. I'm breaking in, shaping up, then checking out on the prison bus. This is it, the apocalypse.
Parallel Lines, the DC Comics Tangent Universe podcast.
Find it bi-weekly on iTunes and at greatkrypton.com.
In the Tangent Universe, you only know the names.
Gathered together from the disparate reaches of geekdom, here in this restaurant booth, are the most powerful forces of geek ever assembled. Ryan, the toy geek. Scott, the award-winning radio host. Jeff, Scott's minion. And Ron, just Ron. Dedicated to truth, justice, and geek for all mankind. It's Dinner for Geeks. Dinner for Geeks proudly crusades at twotruefreaks.com.
And after that depressing issue,
does it get much better?
No, Thomas, this is going to be great. I swear. It's going to be wonderful. I swear it will. I'm trying not to
Kelly
cry.
Clarkson. Let's go back to the happy place.
Yeah, that's true. Let's talk about Kelly Clarkson for the rest of the episode. No, we can't. We've got to talk about the second comic that we're going to be covering today. It's Green Lantern 80-page giant number one. This one was cover dated December 1998 and released on October 21st, 1998. It had a cover price of $4.95 in the United States and $7.50 in Canada. Holy crap, Canada. You're getting pooched.
You got hosed, eh?
Yeah. You know, I hope if anyone buys this now, this is in, like, you know, the dollar or less bins, but yeah.
The water bin.
Yes.
No, they give you money to take it.
Yes, here. We've got an excess supply of them here. You know, you bought your, you know, Superman number 50 or Superman number 32 with Jeff Johns and John Romita Jr. Here, we'll throw this one in as well. Letters were by Bob Lappin and Chrissy Leopoulos throughout the book, and it was edited by Kevin Dooley, and the cover was by Daryl Banks, Terry Austin, and Rob Schwager. While we're talking about the cover, do you want to just go ahead and do that, get that out of the way?
Are we going to talk about receding mullet Sentinel?
You know, sadly, I think Sentinel's haircut was pretty similar to what I had in the 80s. You know, that sort of curly, you know, party in the know, business in the front and party in the back. Yeah, that's.
I also love the fact that everybody's got a different expression.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Sentinel is your disapproving grandpa. John Stewart is played by Barack Obama.
Oh, good lord!
Is like what? What? Is the shoot done? Is this a shoot? Is the shoot where I'm supposed to look? Where? Where? What? Over here? No. Oh. And of course, guys, just like.
He's trying to force out an angry burrito that he had earlier this in the shoot.
Although I find it hilarious that he's billed as Warrior here, and Warrior doesn't show up.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the story that we're going to cover in the book would have been better if it were Warrior.
Yeah.
But yeah, that just... because it's Green Lantern, 80-page giant, you know... Got to have guys Green Lantern. But then, you know, I think Kyle looks decent on the cover.
Yeah.
I think he's got a decent look. But yeah,
Hal's... He looks like, we're going to have fun. And Hal's like, what are you looking at?
I'm going to punch you in the face. yeah, but not the best cover.
And it's such a weird point of view shot, you know?
And it's such a, it's also such a kind of bland background. It's just them standing on a... them standing on a blue garage floor. It's just awful.
And after the shoot, Hal and Kyle go off and work on their cherry hot rod.
Oh, you know, I think that story probably would have been better than a lot of the ones in this book.
Yes.
Let's go ahead and get into it. The first story was called Warrior's Tales, and it was written by Ron Mars, penciled and inked by Tom Greenberg, and colored by Gloria Vasquez.
Who really, by the way, Tom Greenberg really, really wants to be Joan Colin.
Mm-hmm.
Not Joan Collins, Gene Colin.
Gene Colin. Yeah, I can see some of that in there, the artwork there. But, yeah. Our story opens with two of the stupidest burglars in existence trying to break into the Warrior's bar to steal some of the awesome Green Lantern memorabilia. Of course, they're broken up by the arrival of the original Green Lantern, Alan Scott, who frightens them off with a giant non-Barbara Eden genie construct. Walking around to the presumed puddles left by the goons, Alan enters the bar and meets up with a waiting Guy and John, who begin to start their night of drinking and tall tales. Right now, I wish I was drinking. Yes.
Beer. Sweet beer.
I'm going to need one after this. You know, like I said before, if the Green Lantern
beer with
book,
Kelly Clarkson.
Oh, that's a good idea.
I'm trying to stay in the happy place.
I am trying very desperately here. This one, again, like I said, the previous issue... of Green Lantern, if that felt like an inventory story, these are inventory stories.
Oh gosh, yes.
I've read worse, but recently I can't really bring one to mind. The artwork in this is average. That's the best I can say about a lot of the stuff in this book. It's just muddy. I've seen Greenberg do a lot better. And
yeah, I think... Now, who's inking him here?
Let me see here. Pull that up. I guess he's inking himself, because it doesn't give an inker, so it just says artist Tom Greenberg. So it might be bad. My first note for this, because I don't really have too many notes for these stories.
Right.
On page 4, panel 1... as Alan Scott comes into the scene as he's walking in, you know, I'm wondering, you know, who lent the original Green Lantern uniform to Cornelius from Planet of the Apes. I'm sorry, but look at that face. His face. If you take off the green mask and color his hair dark brown, that looks like Roddy McDowall from Planet of the Apes there. Well, a bit more buff, but
yeah.
Oh, that's just not very good art. I do like go ahead.
And then we have on page 5 the sudden appearance of apparently a George Tuska head in panel 2.
Yes.
You know, guy suddenly look. I mean, it's like guy looks like he's pasted in from a different story entirely.
Yeah, it does. That is a weird difference in panel. You know, and the characters' looks change almost from page to page. It's just not the best art by Greidberg. You know, you get the feeling that this was either, like I said, an inventory story that they just slapped together to put in this book, or the artwork was just really rushed for it.
I suspect that the story and the art was rushed as to provide a framing sequence.
That makes sense. You know, and it's an average, you know, I guess it falls in line with, you know, what was going on in the Green Lantern book, that the former Lanterns would meet up and have these little, mm-hmm. you know, just chats talking shit about, you know, what had gone on in their prior runs as Green Lantern. But
you know what this is? This is their way of dumping all the stories they had originally commissioned for Green Lantern Monthly. Green Lantern Quarterly.
Yeah, Green Lantern Quarterly.
Green Lantern Monthly, of course, is what you call Green Lantern.
No, but yeah, that would make sense. It does kind of feel like, yeah, we had extra stories for Green Lantern Quarterly, because some of the people who've written these stories are more contemporary to when the Green Lantern Quarterly story would have came out, because mm-hmm. you've got a story in here later by Dan Jurgens, which I think, you know, he probably would have written that around the time of the quarterly books coming out. So yeah, it makes sense.
By the way, what is it exactly that Guy, the guy who's playing Guy, is pouring into those mugs? Cause it looks like pee to me.
Yeah, I don't know. And the picture doesn't look like a beer pitcher. It just looks like he's pouring from one mug to another mug. It's like, here, I collected this out of the bathroom. Here, drink this.
It's our new special brew. It'll put hair on your chest.
And other places. Yeah, but...
Yeah, we'll get to that in a couple of stories' time.
Yeah, but there's just... There's nothing here just really to... And then, where am I looking on? Page 8. I know that's supposed to be Alan in that third panel there, mm-hmm. but that looks more like Hal. It just... The art looks inconsistent. It's...
I just wonder why they didn't just put an earring in his ear and make him a pirate.
Yo-ho-ho, it would be a pirate's life for him.
And why does Guy keep the severed head of Kilowog?
Well, it's not a severed head. It's his, you know, it's his partially decomposing skull. You know, that's how they honor the dead on Bolivac's Vic. So there you go. Keep their heads in a glass jar. There's probably some neck juice in there as well.
I wonder if you shake it, does like snow go up?
Oh, that would be the most awesome snow globe ever. The disembodied heads of Murdered Lantern snow globe line. Get on that. You know, I would buy those
on,
over
DC.
The lid. I would buy those over those.
Up with the severed limb collection.
That's true, because... Oh, there's been so many severed limbs and torn off limbs and things like that in the DC universe. But
there's a great comic related blog called Every Day is Wednesday. It's done by a guy named Caleb Masaroka. I hope I get that name pronounced correctly.
Okay.
And he said that the DC New 52 should have like a sign up. It's been blank days since our since our last limb loss.
Oh Lord, that is hilarious. Yes, sadly DC has become the comic book equivalent of an abattoir, you know, just losing limbs left and right. Well, let's move on to the next story, which is sadly one of the better stories in this. After this, we get a story about Alan Scott, and his untitled story is written by James Robinson, which is nice, with art by Mike Mayhew and colors by Mike Danza, and it's a tale of his wife and former villain, Harlequin. The time is 1949, and GBS station owner Alan Scott listens to a report of the villain, Harlequin, making a return to Gotham City. Alan leaves the station and heads to the cab of his trusty sidekick, Doibie Dickless. I'm sorry, I mean Doibie Dickles. Yes. Dickles, not Dickless. And ask for info the cabbie has about the ginger gangster. Doobie relates a crime wave that the Harlequin is on, and Alan has Doobie drive him to the home of a Gotham 1%er who had relationships with the people who were hit by the Harlequin. While questioning Mr. Talbot about his concerns over the possible next target, one of Talbot's goons bashes GL on the head with a log, knocking him out, because wood. When Alan awakes, he is tied up and surrounded by a monologuing Talbot and his men. You see, Talbot is a crummy commie and is looking for some data on some citizens of Gotham, so he used the Harlequin's return as cover for his attacks on the men. And, as if on cue, Harlequin busts in and smacks around the commie crumb bums and frees GL.
El Kabong.
Oh, if only El Kabong was in this issue. The duo mop up the goons and then engage in a little sexual tension as they part ways, eventually culminating in the creepy GILF panel at the end of the story.
Now, this is actually a good story.
No, I will admit it. You know, this, and again, James Robinson. So you're not expecting it to be bad. James Robinson can't, for the most part, write a bad story. So it's enjoyable. It's fun. And I like the artwork by, what's his name?
Mike Mayhew.
It really apes the style of a Martin Nodell. There are a couple of panels in here near the end of the story where it looks pretty much like Nodell came in to draw the things. Like, where is it? That four panel page on page 15, where you mm-hmm. see Alan Scott breaking out of the wood, or I guess the handcuffs, and him being tied up, and then firing the ring blast at the gangsters. It has a very Martin Nodell feel, and even the page after that where he's flying through and knocking.
Oh yeah, that top part is so Nodell.
Mm-hmm. It looks really great, and yeah, the story is pretty simple. You know, Green Lantern goes and tracks down some goons, gets hit on the head by a piece of wood, and then busts them up with the help of the Harlequin. And it also kind of ties in, you know, in your comment earlier in the show, how this does kind of feel like a dumping ground for inventory stories from the yeah. Green Lantern Quarterly. This feels like it could have been. This does feel like a story that could have come out from that. I know at the end, James Robinson was writing these stories about Alan Scott. And yes, the stories were about Alan Scott being DH and all that stuff. But it kind of has that feel of an inventory story.
And it's right up. This is right up Robinson's wheelhouse, in that it's about a Golden Age character. And he loved his Golden Age characters.
Oh, yeah. Well, and that's apparent, you know, with what he did with the Golden Age story and how he integrated them into a lot of the Starman issues.
Yeah.
So I like this. It's sad that the Alan Scott story, in a time where Kyle Rayner is the big thing in the DC universe, is perhaps the most enjoyable story in this 80-page mm-hmm. giant. So. I almost said 8-page giant. That would have been significantly better if they could have
just the James Robinson story.
It was just
story.
The James Robinson story, and everything else was kind of chucked out. But yeah, I liked it. It was good. You know, the final panel, I don't know what happened with Mayhew's art and why he gave, you know, Alan Scott sort of the Angels costume with the weird half mask thing, or maybe they just miscolored his mask, but
yeah,
that's weird. And then the creepy cloud formation of the Harlequin getting
she
ready
looks to... more closer in age to Molly now than yeah. she did back then.
Yeah, she's gonna swallow your soul. It's creepy.
Dead by dawn.
She's gonna pop out, and they're gonna slam her head down, and her eyeball's gonna fly out. It's gonna be creepy.
Evil Dead 2.
I'd rather be watching that right now. Okay.
With Kelly Clarkson.
Oh, she'd be wonderful. Moving on, sadly. The next story, entitled Before I'd Be a Slave, was written by, guess who? Who do you think it'd be written by? Yeah, it's Dennis O'Neill. Yeah, Denny O'Neill, with art by Rodolfo DiMaggio. And it begins with a very young John Stewart stopping in Clansville, Arkansas, and hearing a politely racist speech about how the very, very white community should deal with its black population. John decides, rather than delivering some consequences, copyright Allen and Emily Middleton, 2014, all rights reserved, to the crowd of crackers, he'd take a little trip into space.
Crowd of crackers, that's another CBS sitcom.
Airing after Big Bang Theory, and probably significantly better. Upon reaching an undefined distance from Earth and having a little chat with a Guardian, John sees an alien vessel adrift in an area of space called the Propomial Display?
Yeah.
Okay, sure. John rescues the ship and deposits it on a habitable planet, only to find that the aliens on board are just as racist as the folks in Clansville. John frees the slave aliens, and despite their desire to be slaves, he teaches them to live as free beings. Wow, a story dealing with social issues written by Denny O'Neill. Who would have thought? I mean, this is, again,
this is poor.
Yeah, especially for Denny O'Neill. You attribute Denny O'Neill for the Green Lantern Green Arrow run with him and Adams doing impeccable stuff there. And at the time, it was very edgy. This is the late 1990s. Things are far more nuanced. This just is a big smack in the face. And it's I don't like the ending of it. You know, I understand John having a thing against slavery and the ideas behind it. And obviously, the idea of slavery is a bad thing. But this is just handled really poorly. There's no ramifications for these little aliens that he saves. He's just basically, you know, uprooted these people and said, okay, now start making your own lives. What kind of, you know, it's one of those things where it's very short-sighted, I think, on the character of John to just say, oh, I freed the slaves, now everything's going to be perfect. Well,
I mean, it's a story where everybody kind of talks in aphorisms. They don't talk in dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And should we address the 9-inch elephant in the room?
Sure, go ahead.
Green Lantern batch.
Okay.
Page 3. That is an embarrassing photo.
Yes. The less said about that, the better.
Yes. I mean, there's some nice panels in here. The big panel with the cloud from the first Star Trek movie.
Mm-hmm.
That's nice.
Oh, yeah, there's some good artwork. I don't doubt that Rodolfo DiMaggio does a good job here. From what I know of him, he did a lot of work, I guess, on the Green Arrow story. That's where I've encountered him on the show in some of the crossovers with Green Lantern, Green Arrow, where Connor was Green Arrow.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's a very heavy-handed story. I understand that O'Neill is trying to write a story, you know, dealing with racism and... But it's
also nice to know where that weird chick who sang in Return of the Jedi came from.
Where are you seeing that?
The racist aliens.
Oh yeah. It's just average.
Yeah.
So again, inventory stories that are just getting dumped here. And this has been one of the more depressing comics that I've covered in a while.
Let's go back to our happy place now.
Okay, Kelly Clarkson watching Evil Dead with her.
With beer.
That's true. But luckily, things may be looking up a little bit, as the next story is a Bo Smith pen story. And it was, like I said, written by Bo Smith and penciled by Mitch Bird, so you would think that I would think this was awesome.
Friend of the podcast, Bo Smith.
Yes, and inked by Dan Davis. So we've got pretty much the crew from Guy Gardner Warrior in my favorite era. It was colored by Pamela Rambo and had a title of Law of the Jungle. So it's Guy Gardner being Tarzan. You would think that would be awesome. Well,
yes.
We'll see. called to apprehend some Motaran criminals, which I thought that was a Nebula in Star Trek II, on the jungle planet of Hogarth, Green Lantern Guy Gardner beats all the ass without even using his ring. The end.
Right. And with the help of Gorgo the giant rhinoceros.
Mm-hmm. I think we discussed this off air, or we might have discussed on air prior to this, but I think this story would have worked significantly better if this were Guy Gardner Warrior rather than Guy Gardner Green Lantern, because the way Bo Smith is writing it, he's writing it with Guy not using the ring at all.
It would be even better if it was Guy Gardner from that brief period in between the Yellow Ring and Guy Gardner Warrior.
You mean with the crappy Booster Gold armor? Or
No. When he became the two-fisted kicker of ass.
Yes, when he was doing the jungle expedition.
Guy. Yes.
Yeah, that would have been awesome. But unfortunately, he wouldn't have, impetus for being on a planet with a very, very... I'm looking at that second page of the story.
What is up with that girl's thunder sock? Huh?
I was going to say, how does she walk with those thighs? I mean, the Thighmaster must have been constantly in motion with her because those things are huge. But that's kind of a trope of Mitch Bird. Mitch Bird likes to draw his very
curvy.
I want to say Botticellian females. Mm-hmm. They're very top heavy and very hippie. But the artwork is very clean. Dan Davis does a nice job at inking them. It's very detailed without being muddy and kind of that way that the first Guy Gardner annual was. It's just kind of an inconsequential story where just Guy goes around and beats ass.
Mm-hmm.
Bo Smith does a good job at telling the story, but overall, again, it feels like an inventory story from the Green Lantern Corps Quarterly era. So... I don't know. Do you have anything more to say about it? I enjoyed it.
Yeah, no. I mean, it's a little... You get the impression that Bo Smith came up with the image of Guy doing his Tarzan impersonation and built it up from there.
Yeah, because at the end, I'm looking at that... what is it? Page 32, where Guy is standing on the tree in his loincloth, but he still has his... Guy Gardner moon boots on.
Yeah.
And the bowl cut. I mean, I think Bo and Mitch Bird were definitely going for the idea of Guy Gardner, Warlord of Mars, or Guy Gardner Tarzan. So it's an interesting concept, but again, it just feels very fillery. Like I said, good art throughout there from Mitch Bird, but if you're not a fan of Mitch Bird's art, you may not like this very much. But I enjoyed it for what it was. It's a far more enjoyable story than some other stuff that we'll get in here.
Oh, yeah.
But, we've got to continue on, I guess. So let's go ahead and move on to the next story, which was entitled Lessons. And it was written and penciled by Dan Jurgens, which also gives me feel that, hey, this might not have been an original story for this. Mm-hmm. It was inked by Art DeBaer and Jim Royal and colored by Jason Wright, and it goes a little something like this. Hal Jordan, Kel Surprise, is testing an experimental Ferris aircraft to its limits as Carol and her grumpy fart of a father watch on. Suddenly, a worm-filled robot disintegrates the plane because they were searching for a pilot to help them to be smarter, faster worms. Whatever. Hal does some ring magic on the alien annelids, allowing them to better work out in their mech suit, and in appreciation for making them Spartan stuff, the worms recreate the Ferris jet, getting Hal out of trouble with his boss. I've done really short synopses for these because I'm just not all that thrilled with them. Starting off on that first page of the story, John Stewart on there on the far left side.
Right.
I think that's Grindberg again, and that just it looks like he's Apollo Creed.
Hey.
Movie. It just looks all kinds of messed up.
Yeah.
Ain't
gonna be no rematch.
you know, Jurgen's art in here is nice.
Yeah.
It's very clean, and Tiber does a good job at making him, but overall, it's just a typical story. Hal's flying a plane, he screws up and crashes it, has to turn Green Lantern, and finds and a robot filmed with worms that he helps. This is just a bad inventory story. You know, it's only made good, I think, by the artwork by Dan Jurgens.
Right.
I mean, everything, all the artwork is passable. It really looks good. How transforming, I'm looking at the page where he first encounters the big worm-filled robot. You know, the split panel of Hal on his flight suit and Hal changing to Green Lantern is nice. But overall, just a really inconsequential story that... inventories.
Yeah. Of course, it does finish with the absolutely hilarious picture of Worm Green Lantern.
Oh, God. Was that actually a Green Lantern?
No, it wasn't. I think they kind of created that specifically.
I would be so, so enamored to follow a story of the Worm Green Lantern. That would just be... If they could spin him off into his own series or put him into the new Green Lantern core book, that would be awesome. I'd love to read that. And if you can't tell, that is sarcasm, folks.
Yes.
It would completely suck the life out of that story.
Does that mean his major villain would be Mr. Mind?
Oh, well, you know, that actually might be kind of interesting. If they could get, you know, sort of Power Shazam era Jerry Ordway to do a story about that, I'd be fine with that. All right, folks, gird your loins, because here it comes. The next story in the book is called Shepherd. And after a little interlude at the Warriors Bar, we get this story, written by our favorite.
Go away, Ben Rabe.
Go away, Ben Rabe. Penciled by Josh Hood, inked by Jonathan Sabal, and colored by Tom McGraw, who I loved his music. Oh, wait, that's Tim McGraw. I'm sorry. At Kyle Rayner's house. I'm screwing it up so I don't have to talk about it. Yes. At Kyle Rayner's high school, a young Kyle is falling in with the wrong crowd. The trio of 90s stereotypes poke fun at a nerdy underclassman at his locker, which leads to the stereotypical big dumb jock to come to the nerd's defense and challenge Kyle to a fight after school. Not wanting to look bad in the eyes of his quote-unquote friends, Kyle accepts the challenge with the knowledge that they will have his back against the roided-up senior. But come 3 o'clock, it's only Kyle on the football field getting his ass handed to him. Later, at the Rayner home, Kyle has a one-on-one with his mom, who looks very MILF-worthy, discussing how his father followed his conscience in doing what was right, which makes no sense because his father was never there for it. The next day at school, Kyle decides to break away from his so-called friends and defend the nerdy kid who is getting picked on. Is this what we have to look forward with Ben Rabe writing the book?
Yes, unfortunately.
This was not very good at all. If anything makes me feel that this came from the Green Lantern Quarterly book, the 90s era book, this is it, because this has just all the tropes of the 90s.
And this artwork is so bad.
Now, do you remember the story we had with I think it was in the last Alan Scott issue, or last Alan Scott story in the Green Lantern Corps Quarterly, where he was fighting against that horrible, like, image character. What was it? I remember his name. It was Dask Noir. If you remember that character. Even the artwork in that, which was so, so very image chasing, is significantly better than what we've got here. This is just unpleasant to look at. Kyle doesn't look right. It's just bad. Bad overall.
The only moment that is even remotely interesting is the one with his mom.
Mm-hmm. And even his mom looks just kind of off. You know, they haven't really, because in that panel where she's wiping his cheek or whatever, or fixing him up, her eyes, at least in my scan here, look like she's been taken.
Until I read the story, I thought it was a girlfriend.
Yeah, because she's got that sort of pixie cut. She looks very youthful. She's wearing what looks to be like a Letterman sweater or something like that, or like a college team jersey sweater. It doesn't look good at all.
No. And that last page with the little kid, with the nerdy kid,
mm-hmm.
where it looks like he's got serious anime eyes.
Yeah, well, I don't know who, with Josh Hood penciling this, I have no idea what he's worked on before, but yeah, it looks bad. I understand Kyle has an anime influence to his art, and they try and put that in sometimes, but this is just not good at all. And even on the same page, you're talking about anime influence, Guy down here, mm-hmm. he looks like he's, ready to face Goku on this final page. It's just... let's finish this book up. I think we've only got another story, and then we're done. The last one is a bit better. I think you should thank whatever deity you pray to. That the last story is called Whatever Happened to Nort, and was written by Ty Templeton. Unfortunately, not penciled by him. It was penciled by Steve Ellis. Inked by John Lowe and colored by Mike Danza. In a trash-strewn alley, the canine Green Lantern Nort awakens and discusses his predicament with a disheveled wino. Ever since the numerous bumps on the head, as well as his ring fizzling out on him, Nort hasn't been doing much heroing. In fact, he's mainly given in to his more primal urges, such as chasing cars. After eventually catching one and being thrown clear of the bumper, Nort spies the Yellow Guard villain, Catman, and gives chase after him as well. After a few pages of chasing the Marigold Menace, Nort trees Catman, allowing the Fire Brigade to rescue him and take him to jail. Crisis averted, Nort is later honored by the mayor of New York City, who I think we'll have a discussion about later, for helping put an end to crime. But Nort once again falls prey to his primal urges and decides to sniff the mayor's butt, right as he's making a televised speech. And like I said at the beginning of this, I wish Ty Templeton was doing the art chores as well. If this could have been a sort of Superman, the Batman Adventures, the Superman Adventures kind of look, and have that sort of Mike Parabek, Ty Templeton feel to it, I think it would have worked a lot better.
Yeah. Although, give Steve Ellis a credit here. He does do a credible Joe statement.
Yeah, in fact, I was going to say, the Nort here looks a heck of a lot better than I've seen Nort in a while. He does have that very Joe Staten-esque look. I don't have a problem with the artwork. I'm wondering here on the second page where we've got the sixth panel here,
mm-hmm.
Why, what's his name? Gilligan from Dobie Gillis.
Right. Well, you know what? I thought originally that what Ellis was trying to do was because Nort was based on the character played by Art Carney in The Honeymooners.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it does kind of have an Art Carney look. I was thinking more, what's his name?
Bob Denver.
Yeah, Bob Denver. Maynard G. Krebs.
Right.
From Dobie Gillis. It kind of looks like that character with the sort of, not hipster, but beatnik type
beatnik,
look.
Beatnik, yeah.
Yeah. But, it does, now that you mention it, does have a sort of Art Carney look there. So that makes sense. The story is just basically, since the whole fallout of, Emerald Twilight, Emerald Fallout and all that, with all the Green Lanterns losing their ring, it's interesting to hear what happened to Nort. But it's just basically Nort running around chasing things.
Yeah.
So I will admit I had to mention this. I'm not going to be covering this because this is past my era, but the last time that I read Nort, that wasn't in this run, was Collateral Damage, the Howard Chaykin penned and written story about Guy Gardner. And if you have an opportunity to read that, go punch yourself in the face, because that is all kinds of bad. And Nort in that was awful. So I enjoyed Nort here. Now, Catman, is he an established DC villain?
Yes, he was a Batman villain.
Okay.
And basically, he was a cat burglar. He was, and later on, he's taken over by Gail Simone for Suicide Squad and turned into a legitimate badass.
I was going to say, because I remember I want to say it was probably Mike Bailey talking about him on Suicide Squad and how he enjoyed, you know, the sort of the revamping of the character. So that's interesting.
I'm sorry, Secret Six.
Secret Six, yeah. So. But, yeah, decent artwork and an okay story. But again, it's got a very, very inventory feel.
Now, and, of course, Mayor Giuliani having his butt sniffed.
Now, this doesn't look like maybe I'm just not accustomed to Giuliani from this era, because the way I see Giuliani is the glasses Giuliani post 9/11. Do you think they just removed the glasses so they won't?
Frequently I can speak, of course, since he was the mayor of my city for 8 years. Frequently he appeared without his glasses.
Okay.
Although he doesn't look the same in the two panels he's in.
No, he looks, that in that first, the second panel there, he looks a bit, I want to say a bit more Asian. I don't know if that's just me looking at it right, but, he just looks a bit different. But yeah.
And in the second panel, he looks like he's being played by Kevin Spacey.
Oh, a Green Lantern House of Cards crossover. That'd be awesome. We could watch that with Kelly Clarkson as well. That would be awesome. But that ends out the story. There's
a one-page epilogue.
Mm-hmm, written by or drawn by Greinberg again. And it's a little better art, but not amazing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, overall, this is just kind of a... It felt like an inventory dumping ground, like I've said before. And,
this was kind of like the purpose of the first round of 80-page shines, because they did a number of these.
Okay, for the various different titles.
There was a Superman 80-page shine, if I remember. I want to say a JLA one.
But because I know they had the JLA quarterly, so there could have been stuff called from that as well. But
and in a way, 80-page giant, it's a callback to back in the 60s and very early 70s. They had 80-page giants, which were mostly reprints.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just surprised that they didn't do the 100-page giants, which happened right after the DC implosion in the 70s,
mm-hmm.
where a lot of books got kind of folded into a couple of the 100-page books, like Super Team Family, Batman Family, Superman Family, all kinds of family.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that's kind of what we're seeing here with this initial one. And I know they've had a couple more 80-page giants, at least for Green Lantern. And I went ahead and read ahead on those, and they're actually, they don't feel as inventory-tastic as this one. They feel like they actually had people go out and write stories for this rather than culling them from the files and just putting them in there for whatever reason. This one feels really thrown together, and that's just disappointing because, I hate to be down on the issues. It's not that these were bad. Well, except for the Ben Ray one. Go away.
Go away, Ben.
But, this wasn't some of the better output by the Green Lantern books. So, I'm sorry I had you on for a couple of books that were significantly subpar. But, I do have plans on having you back, obviously, Thomas.
Fairly soon, in fact.
I love having you on. Yes, we're going to be coming on very soon to be talking about the start of the Judd Winnick run. Plus, we're also here in a while to sort of plug what's going to be coming up. I'm going to be covering the Green Lantern Aliens or Green Lantern versus Aliens crossover. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about that as well. So I'm looking forward to doing that. But, Thomas, As always, it has been a pleasure getting to talk to you. And even though we didn't get to talk about the best Green Lantern comics out there, at least we got to talk, which is always a pleasure for me.
And we had our happy place.
Yes.
We always had our happy place to retreat to.
Always think about Kelly Clarkson just sitting on the couch and sharing a bucket of popcorn and watching movies.
Right.
It is a happy idea. But Thomas, why don't we go ahead and let people know what kind of things you're doing on and off the internet and where they can find you?
Well, of course, you can find me very irregularly these days on Better in the Dark. We just released a new episode where the two of us and Jim Moon of Hypnobobs talked about Amicus.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm editing the new Obscure Movies episode with gratuitous Roy Orbison.
Oh, that sounds like it'll be interesting. Like I said, I've commented before, I love your obscure horror movie episodes. Mm-hmm. I can't wait to hear what you have for just the obscure movie episode. That'll be fun.
Right. Let's see. I appear on this show called Who True Freaks every once in a while. And I think we've, over on Tricycle Offense, we've restarted the Nocturne Travel Agency.
Oh, cool.
With, where I interview authors. And, there's a new podcast coming out with me and Kaylin B-Connolly called Molly Fog the Music.
Hmm.
So, also, a new Shadow Legion story is coming hopefully very soon.
I can't do that.
Mystery Men and Women. It features the Ferryman, and it's kind of a preview to the second Shadow Legion book, which is called The Shape of Fears to Come.
I'm looking forward to it. Now, you said that one's going to be sort of a, rather than being an overarching story, it's going to be like mm-hmm. four separate stories of each individual character.
Exactly. So we've got one for each of the members of the Shadow Legion.
That'll be interesting to sort of flesh out the individual characters a little bit more and give them their own story to shine in. That'll be cool. I can't wait to read that.
And there are lots in the coming year because apparently, to my surprise, the character a lot of people glommed onto is Dreamcatcher.
Oh, cool.
So there are going to be a number of Dreamcatcher stories in various anthologies.
Yeah, I will admit, she didn't really get a chance to get her character all that well-developed in the first Shadow Legion book. I mean, she was – it seemed like there could have been a lot more done with her. So I'll be interested to see how you take that character and flesh her out. That'll be cool.
Oh, it's going to be – let's see. There's a Christmas story where she investigates a murder where the victim is wrapped up in tinsel and is holding up a sign with the word naughty on it. There's the one where she has to figure out why a dead man is still walking around Nocturne. There's a lot of good stuff coming on. The great thing is in her solo story, she's coming off more like a John Constantine figure.
Oh, that'll be interesting.
You know, and, with Colin Palmersdale kind of as her sidekick. So there's lots of Shadow Legion coming out.
Well, that's good. Well, again, Thomas, thank you for coming on the show. Next time out on the show, we're going to be looking at a new era, starting with Green Lantern number 126, where Kyle is in jail for whatever reason.
Hi, Mom. I'm in jail. I like it here. I have lots of friends. You know why? Because I'm in jail.
And well, we're going to be covering another 80-page giant. This time, hopefully, it won't be filled with inventory crap. But all of that will be next time on another episode of Just One of the Guys. So we hope you come back to, hopefully, some better stuff. Until then, have a good week.
Go away, Ben Rame.
And go away, Ben Rame. Now it's off for popcorn with Kelly Clarkson. You've been listening to Just One of the Guys, a Green Lantern podcast, hosted by yours truly, Sean Engel. All images, stories, and music are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. This podcast is done solely out of my desire to show the denizens of the internet that comic books can be fun, humorous, compelling, thought-provoking, and exciting, while not having to fall into the weary tropes of the 1990s. I'm not in any way doing this for monetary gain, which irritates my wife to no end. All feedback for the show can be sent to the show's Gmail account at justoneoftheguyspodcast@gmail.com. All feedback, positive and negative, is warmly welcomed. All spam bots are warmly welcome too, as long as your definition of a warm welcome is for them to die horribly in a fire. The website address for the show can be found at the brand new Two True Freaks website at twotruefreaks.com. There you can find the RSS feed as well as skins, the covers, and whatever else I feel like putting up. Look for me on iTunes. Just search for Just One of the Guys podcast, or search for Two True Freaks, the numeral 2, and you can subscribe to the show there. You can also search me on Facebook, and now you can actually find me there, as it was a requirement of my new DemonsCore contract. But it doesn't mean that I'll be joining your little Candy Crush group anytime soon. Thanks for downloading and listening, and come back next Friday for another episode of Just One of the Guys, a Green Lantern podcast. The opening song for today's show was Semisonic and their song Closing Time, off the album Feeling Strangely Fine, a seminal 90s song. If you'd like to buy this song, or perhaps any other song by Semisonic, or any other music you think would interest you, I would suggest that you should go to Amazon.com to purchase those MP3s, CDs, or even records. I would also suggest you go through the link at twotruefreaks.com. Whenever you go to twotruefreaks.com and click the link on the banner page up in the upper left-hand corner, you'll be transported to Amazon.com where you could buy Semisonic, Blur, Farouk Assault, any number of 90s bands that really didn't make it as big as Nirvana. And any time you buy from Amazon.com through the link at twotruefreaks.com, a small amount of your purchase price comes back to the website. It won't cost you anything extra, and it really, really helps the podcast out. So, anytime you're thinking about buying some wonderful one-hit wonders from the 1990s, make sure you use the link to Amazon at twotruefreaks.com.
Stupid Jim Lee costume aside.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is the period where Kyle turns in his classic costume for one that is very New 52-tastic.
Mm-hmm.
Designed by Jim Lee.
Okay. See, that makes sense because, yeah, I don't. I've seen the changes in the costume. I understand that when Kyle came into the book, his costume was very much a part of that sort of 90s aesthetic. It did kind of feel, but I thought it was far more classic. I think, Kyle's uniform aged much better than the Parallax uniform from that era.
Yeah.
I thought it worked a heck of a lot better, and I'll have to see how I feel about the changes in the uniform when we get to it, but it's hold on, sorry, it's my daughter. Hello.
Hello.
She
doesn't like the book either.
No, she's listening to stuff on her iPod. Okay.
I think we've started a new internet meme.
Go away, Ben Rabe.
Yes.
I'm fine with that.